Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The 2022 Australian election will be known as the Independence Election. Fiery women are running for office around the country. Middle class, professional, white, and angry, they are running in traditionally conservative liberal seats. They are fed up with traditional politics and are calling for serious action on climate change and demanding integrity. But where did this all come from? In 2013, in a quiet region in the state of Victoria, in an electorate known as Indi, a modest local candidate called Cathy McGowan won the seat in a shock. She came to power not only because she was a powerful candidate, but because she was part of a magnificently powerful movement. Voices for Indi did things like kitchen table conversations and community meetings that ignited participation across the electorate. And this has now birthed a national movement. Today's chat is with Nick Haynes. Nick has been part of this movement from the beginning. He was part of Cathy's campaign, then he worked with her in Parliament House. And his mum, Helen Haynes, became Cathy's successor as the member for Indi. Today we talk about that story and some of the grassroots tactics that this movement has adapted from community organising and deployed in the electoral arena. We look at what it means for a grassroots movement to win and how that can challenge and change how it works. And we look at the role of place in all of this and how the hopes and challenges that arise when something that started so local goes national. Nick is part of a team writing a book about all this. It's called The People Are Interested in Politics. You can pre-order it from Laneway Press and use the discount code CHANGEMAKER. But today, let's lean into the story that's taking Australian politics by storm. Let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers is supported by the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Changemakers also runs an organising school where you can sharpen your skills to make change in the world. All the details are on our website, where you can also go to sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Nick, welcome to Changemakers.
Thanks, Amanda.
So it's pretty exciting having you on air moments before the Australian election that features a million independents. Just so everyone in our audience is clear about your kind of change making, if you were to sum up the kind of change that you make in the world at the moment, what kind of change maker are you?
Well, I guess I would describe myself as a campaigner. So I work for a global organisation called Some of Us. We are about 20 million members across the world and we campaign...
Oh, only 20 million?
Only 20 million, yeah. and we campaign to hold big corporations accountable. So we're kind of a... I guess we fit in that sort of like mass mobilisation, digital mobilisation kind of model. And yeah, it's my great privilege to work there and help run campaigns, particularly around climate finance is my main focus, but I would say, yeah, I would describe myself as a campaigner.
Cool. So that's your day job and we love your day job, but you also, you know, by day you might campaign for the Some of Us, but at night and on weekends, you also do some other work. Tell us about the work that you've been doing on election campaigning. What kind of change making you've been doing there?
Yeah, so I guess it's sort of the origin of where I got into this, like to change making, I guess, is electoral politics. And as a result, it's still something that's of great interest and excitement to me. Right now, as we're, you know, a few days out from the federal election, I'm, you know, spending my evenings and some weekends helping campaign in Indi, in the federal electorate of Indi, where, incidentally, my mum is running for re-election. Yeah.
She must be proud. Man, if my kids were helping me be an independent and awesome, she must be so proud of your support.
Yeah, who knows, I guess.
Yeah, I'm without doubt, actually. So let's find out the story, right? I'm particularly interested in the night and weekend part of your work and your work in Indi, which is a regional Victorian seat that's an important seat in federal politics. But tell us a little bit about why you got involved in all this change-making stuff in the first place. You know, not everyone needs to try and change the world. Where did it come from for you?
Yeah, so I grew up in a town called Wangaratta, which is in the federal electorate of Indi in northeast Victoria. It's about three hours north of Melbourne. Grew up on a little farm there outside of town on the banks of the King River. It's a very beautiful place to grow up, but you know, also a place that, you know, in the background of my childhood there, I guess, you know, this, if I look back on it now, I can see the kind of the through line, I guess, of climate change and you know, environmental impacts kind of through my childhood there, you know, living through the millennium drought and seeing the, you know, river recede and bushfires, you know, season after season. Like, I think that was sort of the beginning, I guess, of forming the background, I guess, in my mind around what I was seeing on a local level, I guess, is connected to something more important and larger than that. I guess in some ways, though, my childhood wasn't probably overly political. I think, you know, we talked about politics at home. You know, we watched the news at night, but it didn't feel like often that politics, I guess, extended beyond the front door in some ways. In one of the people, I guess, who was most inspirational to me was probably my grandmother, who in her own very sort of quiet and non-confrontational way was, you know, quite a radical. And I remember going down to visit her in Melbourne, in her home in the kind of pretty conservative and leafy eastern suburbs of Melbourne. And she had this whole drawer full of badges from, you know, anti-nuclear rallies and a whole range of other stuff. This kind of radical sort of pamphlets and magazines and materials, which did not really square with her outward appearance as a pretty polite, you know, lady from the eastern suburbs. So it was talking to her, I think, that really got me interested, particularly in climate. She was talking about climate change, you know, long before I can, you know, I can remember it being a sort of a broad topic of conversation. She was originally a scientist at the CSIRO, but she was, you know, forced to resign when she got married, as was the time, you know, as was typical, I guess, at that time. So I think in some ways she was somebody who was radicalized by science in her own way, and she had the kind of quiet impact on me around the importance of politics and social movements.
Wow. A radical scientist who also went to anti-nuclear marches was part of your political development.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Like, what do you reckon? How do you reckon your relationship with her changed you?
That's a good question. I mean, one of the things she was famous for, she was a one-woman kind of news clipping service. You would, whenever you visited her, you would get a stack of clipped out articles from the paper. And I mean, she was always, you know, completely across current affairs and news and science as well. And I think that she certainly sort of drove into me a love of kind of poring over the newspaper and listening to the ABC. And I think that was kind of her impact on many members of the family in some ways. But I think she also showed me the, you know, and her impact, I guess, on me was that, like, there's more than one way, I guess, to be a change maker. In her case, it was not, you know, she was not a confrontational person. She was not someone who was in your face, but she had a very resolute kind of set of principles, I guess, and that was really grounded in science for her. And I think that had an impact on me in the sense that, you know, you can hold these values very tightly, and also you know, exist in the world in whatever way you're kind of, you know, your relationships do. It doesn't, I guess. There's not one type of change maker or, you know, or radical or, you know, of any sort.
Yeah. And you could still be that, and you could be in regional Victoria and hold that space, right? Like, you know, she was,
yeah,
able to be.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, for me, it did feel like, you know, that was a separate world, you know, that politics didn't really happen in the country. That this was, you know, something that happened in Melbourne, the marches and the rallies and stuff happened in Melbourne. It just didn't really occur in the country. And it sort of, and it didn't talk, you know, it didn't talk about politics at school that much, or, you know, you didn't kind of, it just felt like politics didn't happen in the country. Yeah. So it did feel distinct to me.
Yeah. Okay. So you went off to university. How did that experience shape your later decisions to become more involved in political work?
So I guess I enrolled in an arts degree, majoring in political science at Melbourne Uni, and I thought for myself, like, oh, this would be great. I'll get really into student politics and, you know, campus politics, and quickly realized that that was not a place I really wanted to be. I mean, I think I guess my impression of campus politics
was, change the world.
No, I think it was like LinkedIn kind of like resume building for aspiring politicians, and it was, you know, pretty nasty and inward facing. So I didn't get very involved there, to be honest. I guess it wasn't probably until later. I was in my second year, I went and on an exchange program to University in Montreal and continued studying politics there. But the type of politics that was kind of I was studying there was very different to what I was learning at Melbourne Uni. And it was far more practical and far, you know, more rooted in social movement theory and learn all about social capital and civic engagement, which were not topics I'd ever really learned about before. And so that had a big impact on me. And, you know, at the same time as that, just as I got to Montreal, it was the beginning of the enormous student protests, which would essentially shut down the province there for over a year. What later became what some people call the Maple Spring. It's a controversial term, but like that was an extraordinary time to be there, where the entire province really, and all the universities in the province, bar the one I was at actually, went on strike. So all universities shut down. And it was all over changes to higher education fees, which to me still seemed crazily cheap compared to what they cost in Australia. But that was an extraordinary time there. And it was seeing these enormous, enormous protests on the street, which, you know, went for kilometers and shut down the city for entire days. And seeing that at the same time as being in a classroom and learning about social movement theory and learning about, you know, reading, you know, Bowling Alone and these kind of books about, you know, social capital, and seeing that in play out in practice on the street had a really big impact on me. And it felt, yeah, that was a turning point for sure.
And so what did it turn you towards?
Well, at the same time as that, it was back home, there was a group of 12 people who were starting to meet in the library in Wangaratta, kind of quiet multi-purpose room at the back. And my dad was one of those 12 people. And he was telling me about this group that was forming to kind of come together and sort of discuss the quality of political representation that they had in Indi. So Indi at the time, and for the kind of 11 years preceding that, was represented by Sophie Mirabella, who was a very controversial figure in Australian politics. And so this group of 12 people, including Cathy McGowan, was one of them.
For our audience services, so she's part of the Liberal Party. She's quite a conservative person. Yeah.
Yes, she would be on the right flank of the Liberal Party and a reputation for being quite a firebrand MP. So she'd been sort of parachuted into the seat of Indi 12 years or 11 years prior. And so this group of constituents of citizens of Indi were coming together very quietly and very tentatively at that stage in this room at the library to discuss what could be done about the quality of representation in Indi. And so that was happening at the same time as I was learning about this stuff in Canada. And I was in kind of constant contact with my dad, hearing about these plans as they were forming. And I couldn't wait to get back and get into it myself.
So we're in the back of the library. There are 12 citizens talking about the lack of political representation in Indi. So how did that, what did that evolve into? Tell us the story of how it turned into a movement for change.
Well, first of all, I think the name Voices for Indi is important because it involved a lot of talking at first, like a lot of deliberative, difficult kind of conversation to sort of unpack what there was to do and what and how it could be done. And I guess the discussion that was had in that room initially, it initially began with a call to Cathy McGowan from her niece and nephew in Melbourne saying, Cathy, you're a well-known figure in the local community in Indi. You need to do something about the quality of representation in Indi. There needs to be a discussion around, you know, fielding a better candidate potentially to run against Sophie Mirabella. So that was one starting point, but that wasn't the starting point for everyone in that group. It wasn't necessarily set out to run an independent candidate against Sophie Mirabella. The discussion that was had there was like, Sophie Mirabella she was a fierce advocate for the for the things she believed in. She was an ideologue, really. And she had a very, very safe seat in Parliament. So she was able to prosecute the arguments she wanted to prosecute very hard without, I guess, really being in a safe seat meant she was kind of buffered, I guess, or having to really represent the views of her constituents. Or in the views of everyone in that room, those 12 people in the room, they didn't think that the values that Sophie Mirabella talked about necessarily represented the values of the community they knew and they've been a part of their whole lives. And the reason for that was being in a safe seat meant she was afforded this safety, I guess, to go and prosecute the arguments she cared about, not necessarily what the views of her constituents were. And so this group, which would become known as Voices for Indi, said it wanted to find out what the views of the community were. Like, is our theory actually right that what our MP talks about doesn't really reflect the views of the constituents she's there to represent? And that was the kind of the launching point.
So, right. Firstly, that's interesting, right? A lot of people, when they approach a political conversation, don't necessarily go, oh, we might be wrong. We've got to go listen to everyone and check. Where did that instinct, do you know where that instinct came from in the group? I mean, it's incredibly healthy and powerful. It's probably why the movement was able to thrive. Most political parties don't do that, right? They stay insular. You went open. Where did that come from? Why did people choose to be so open?
I think that's the key difference, because there was not, political parties start at a shared ideological or values basis. This group didn't have that. There was no common political thread connecting them. There was a variety of political views and backgrounds in the group, and they also didn't discuss what those views really were. It was very ideology neutral, and so there was no, I guess, starting off point of a shared way of viewing the world. What was started instead was forming a shared set of values, and that was really intrinsic to the first several months of Voice for Indi's kind of formulation, was like agreeing on what these values were that would hold the group together, not about issues or policies or positions.
Right. Okay. So holding a space together, they wanted to go out and find out what other people thought about, you know, this idea of a political discontent, whether they were being well represented or not. How did they do that?
So the idea came from the Victorian Women's Trust, who during the Kennett years had run a campaign or a project called the Purple Sage Project. And Cathy McGowan and Alana Johnson and some of the other members of Rowan O'Hagan, other members of the Voice for Indi group, were involved in the Women's Trust. So they had a sort of, I guess, grounding in this community organizing theory, although I guess probably wouldn't have talked about it in that way. And so the kitchen table conversations was the key kind of idea, really. And so the thought was, okay, if we want to find out what the actual views and values and beliefs are of Indi, we need a way to consult people and to bring those together. And people, I think, were kind of wary of, you know, consultation in a tokenistic way. And so the kitchen table conversation process, as kind of derived from the Purple Sage Project, was about bringing people together for a slow and kind of deliberative conversation. There was broad questions. There was a facilitation pack provided to each kitchen table host that had a bunch of questions which didn't really have defined answers, yes or no answers. They were meant to elicit conversation. And the role and the purpose was to bring people of kind of no consistent beliefs or ideologies together, have this open conversation in a very intentional way, and make space for divergent views, and then record the notes of those conversations and compile them all together.
Cool. Did you go to can you tell us what it's like? Like, do you remember going to one with lots of divergent views? How is the space held?
Yeah, I did go to one in Melbourne. It was mostly people my age who were, quote unquote, later came to refer to us as the Indi expats. So we were we were mostly uni students who'd grown up in Indi and were living in Melbourne at now for study. So I did go to one, and it was a process, I guess, of slowly moving through, starting with kind of values questions, like what do you value in political leadership? Like, what do you think good political leadership looks like? And a lot of that was around character and values and outlook. And then that kind of moved more into kind of issues and what were the kind of things that really impacted you on a personal level in that community. And I think those two things were the key, I guess, products that came out of the conversation. Aside from the kind of community organizing product which came out of it, which is a whole other thing, I think what those conversations led to was this kitchen table report, which really gave a charter of values and of leadership principles and of policy areas and of topics that were important to the almost 500 people across the electorate who took part in the process.
So what was the gap between when those kitchen table conversations were held in the following election in 2013, wasn't it?
Yeah, this happened over the course of 2012 and early 2013, and then the election was later in 2013, yeah.
So we're talking quite a long period of time, 18 months, 2 years worth of work.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And there was a lot of time before that, before kind of V4I or Voices for Indi stepped out publicly. There was this long process of kind of sorting through these difficult questions of, you know, how to approach this. And so the pivotal moment came when V4I stepped out as an organization, came when they met with Sophie Mirabella for the first time. So on the advice of Tim Fisher, the former deputy PM, who was a relative actually of Cathy McGowan's, she went to him and talked about Voice for Indi and what they were planning to do. And his advice was, well, make sure you go to Sophie Mirabella first and tell her what you're planning. You don't want to, you know, spring this on us as a surprise. And so Cathy and one other member of Voice for Indi went and met with Sophie before the launch of the kitchen table process and informed her of what they were planning to do. And Sophie, they met in the lobby of her office. The meeting went for 11 minutes. And Sophie Mirabella's response was, the people of Indi are not interested in politics.
Oh, right.
And that incidentally is the basis of the title of the book, which we are now writing about.
I understand.
Yeah. And so mostly because, I mean, that assumption from Sophie Mirabella about her constituents was, I think, a very insightful view into how she saw her role as a representative.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do it for you. Don't worry about it. You just get on with your happy lives and I'll take care of business.
Mm.
Yeah, it does say a lot. And so, okay, so you do the kitchen table conversations, you build up this sort of thickening community set of relationships across divergent views while also getting a sense of the kind of leadership qualities and key issues that are felt in the electorate. You write, there's a sort of, putting that together as a sort of document. Then what happened? That sounds good, but how did that turn into, you know, what we now know happened?
Yeah. So all along there was this kind of two threads of opinion about could we run an independent candidate? Should we not? There was kind of divergent views on that. The kitchen table conversation report really, I think, gave strength to the view that actually running a candidate to champion these values, these issues, is the best way to get these on the agenda. So the goal was always, okay, we'll present this charter of Indi, this report showing all the issues, we'll present that to all candidates in the election and they can all run on it. But then there was, based on the kind of the feedback, particularly around quality representation, there was clear interest from the people who participated in this that they need a representative to champion these values. So out of that came a process then to find an independent candidate to run and to champion these issues and these values. And so a process over the course of quite a few weeks, there was a lot of shoulder tapping going on, of people reaching out to kind of local identities in the community, people that they thought could be potentially interested in this. We even, or Voices for Indi rather, took out ads in the local paper asking for kind of open application of candidates. People who were interested in running for as an independent, could you apply and apply to Voice for Indi and we'll go through a process of kind of selecting the candidate. And the process was very rooted in the values that V4I had established and trying to find someone who could be the best exemplar and champion of those values. And what they found was it was very hard to find someone who was willing to step up. And I think a lot of that was informed by a fear of retribution, which is a fear of a very personal and ugly and reputationally damaging campaign. And so where they got to was they could not find really anyone who was willing to do this. And so Cathy McGowan, who at that point was the chair of Voice for Indi, she said, well, if no one else will do it, I'll put my hand in the ring. I will withdraw myself from V4I and I will go through the same process that had been established, independent process as any other person who would had they applied for it also. And so Cathy did, and she was selected. And through this process, run by the kind of committee of Voice for Indi, which she had stepped out of. And then Later in 2013, she stepped out as the candidate. So Voice for Indi held a big event in Wangaratta to announce that they had selected a candidate, or they had kind of invited a candidate rather to step forward. That was Cathy McGowan. So she stepped forward, and there was I think 300 and something people in the room that day for this candidate's launch. Which, I mean, I think is one of the key things that sets this apart from other independent, you know, plenty of independents have run in the past in Australian politics, but I think what was very different about this was an independent who on the first day they stepped out was stepping out with over 300 people there ready to go in with them. And I think that was the real difference. And so Cathy stepped out and said, I'm willing to run as an independent. I'm willing to champion the values and the issues that were set out in this report. And that was the beginning of what became a rapidly snowballing campaign.
And there's so much. So, I mean, even if it wasn't intentionally at the time, it was intentional, but even if they weren't using the same words, there's so much that's similar to how community organizing talks about power and how the Voices for Indi did. Like, organizing talks about building your power before you use your power. And that's what you did, you know, and perhaps that's one of the elements as to why it was so successful, is that you actually were so intentional about the community of people who were going to support the space before stepping out, having a candidate step out. I mean, it's very, very sort of remarkable piece, because, I mean, it was going to be a tough battle. Sophie Mirabella, she wasn't a marginal electorate, right?
Not at all. I mean, Indi has been a blue ribbon coalition seat since Federation. It's only once in its history has it not been held by the Liberal or by one of the Conservative parties, which was when the Country Party candidate forgot to nominate in sometime in the 20th century. There's only one time. So the Labor accidentally snapped it for one term. But prior to that, it is an extremely safe seat. Sophie Mirabella was on a very, very comfortable margin. And you're right. I think that the key thing that I think people were just not really, the idea of turning up to a political rally in Wangaratta was not something that was really on the menu, really. It was, and I think the other key thing, apart from building power before you wield it, was also getting, I guess, cohesion around that value, those values. There was not an ideological cohesion. There was not a worldview cohesion. There was cohesion around the values. And that was important, I think, because the other thing that was important about this was that there was no, there was a view that in order to get people to come along, we had to, in some ways, depoliticize it a bit. We had to make the idea of, like, getting into an ugly fight, you know, an ugly personal fight, to take that out of the equation in order to make it a space people felt like they would actually want to walk into. And that was important too, I think. And so one of the things that happened was that everyone who signed on then to become a volunteer of the campaign had to sign an actual kind of, you know, contract, really, a statement which stepped out those values, which included never going personal, never attacking the opposition in any kind of personal way, sticking to being our quote-unquote best selves, as Cathy would, you know, say very often. And it was kind of, you know, Pollyanna-ish in some ways, but it was like, it was important and it held the group together and meant there was never a breach of that, really. You know, that the group really held firm and did stay positive.
Oh, they don't need to be, it doesn't need to be Pollyanna to be nice to one another. Jeepers creepers. I wish there was just a bit more of that in our politics. So tell us, you know, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but, you know, between, so that you launch with 300 people, right? How do you take it from there to victory? Like, what does that process look like of taking this piece of work across the electorate and winning?
Yeah, I mean, it was really a case of building the plane as we were flying it. I mean, no one amongst us had run a political campaign, really. By that point, I was back in Australia and I was in my final semester at uni, but I was like, okay.
Well, you were like a law student who understands all of the law, right? You were an expert.
I was enrolled to study law the following year, but that was in my final semester of my undergrad. And I was like, okay, this is boring. I'm moving home. This is far more interesting up here. And so we set about kind of just building the ship as we flew, building the plane as we flew it. So, like, the first thing was finding physical spaces, and that was important. We got an office donated to us in Wodonga, and then we opened another one in Wangaratta. And then having those spaces, they became the kind of organizing hubs, and they that's what we call them. They were the hubs, and they were the places that Indi. I mean, it's important to understand the geography a little bit of Indi. It's in the northeast of Victoria, so it's very mountainous. It's defined by its valleys and waterways, and so that physical geography also underpins the human geography. I mean, people live up these valleys and they come into one of the main towns for, you know, key services. So setting up those hubs in those main towns, so from the top to the bottom of the electorate, and it's a huge electorate. It's bigger than Belgium. It's 22,000 square kilometers. You know, it's and so they would set up these hubs one by one down the length of the electorate, and they will become the kind of locus, the sort of focal point in that area. And then it was a case of really, even though we probably didn't refer to it as such, it became a distributed organizing strategy. It was to really devolve leadership. There was very little hierarchy. Basically, the view was like, if you're signed up to the values and you stick to those, go forth and do whatever you like. You understand your community's best. And the people just really took to it in an extraordinary way and started like organizing just events after events after events, and the channels of people kind of flowing in. And I think one of the things that made this possible, which maybe wouldn't have made it possible some years earlier, was digital, you know, organizing strategies. And that was where I was really interested, and that was what kind of kept me into this. While I was at uni in Canada, I was in this doing this subject on election campaigning. I was reading and writing essays on like the Obama campaign, and I found this magazine for political consultants, which advertised this product, Nation Builder, which at the time was pretty new in Australia, hadn't really been used much. And so I set up, along with one other person, set up that, and that really became important for us, because even though we had this very scattered, distributed campaign that was happening all across this electorate, everyone was being channeled back through the website, and we were collecting that information, and we could organize people with some centrality, but in a way that just happened very organically and very rapidly kind of all throughout the electorate.
So you had people power in the centers, in the valleys as people came down, and you had digital relationships that were connecting this distributed network. You clearly had a lot of passion on the ground because people were prepared to drive the change on their own. Do you remember election night?
Yes, I sure do. it was, I mean, in the final week of the campaign, there was this poll that came, or two important things happened prior to this. One was that an email got leaked from Sophie Mirabella's camp, which showed that she was being outgunned and outflanked by the far more active McGowan campaign. And that was the first key moment which gave us national attention and gave us an insight, actually, maybe we could do something. But that being said, I still don't think, I never thought we could win. Some people might have. I regret not putting a bet on when Kathy was paying $50 odds, but I never thought we'd win, really. I was like, okay, we'll run a good shot, we'll run a great campaign, and then next time around, we'll have established Voice for Indo, we'll have established this group. And over the 3 years, and this was coming into the beginning of the Abbott government, over the beginning of those next three years, we would hold Sophie Mirabella to account as Voice for Indo. But on election night, what started to happen is we started to get booth numbers in, and we had scrutineers at every little booth. We had huge numbers of people out on polling day. And these booths are kind of, you know, some of them are like 80 votes. And so like they start coming in. I remember I was setting up my computer because I was one of the people who was controlling the sort of tally room. And it was like 6 o'clock, you know, the booths had only just closed. And I thought I had a couple of hour or two to get ready. The phone started ringing from these small booths, like, we've won Bethanga, we've won, you know, Piri's Goffs Bay, these tiny, tiny little booths which get counted in about 20 minutes. I'm like, oh, wow, okay, that's funny. and then it just began this stampede. And then the room, this little sort of side room of the party that we'd set up for the tally room became the main party. Everyone was crowded in there. And each time we would get a booth rung in, we would yell out and try and find a volunteer from that area. And they'd come up and announce the numbers from that booth. And it was just this electric atmosphere. And suddenly all the press, which had been at Sophie Mirabella's party, which was turning very sour, they flooded over here and were crowding in the room. There were cameras. There was texts coming in from Fran Kelly, who was on the ABC decision desk, asking what's going on. Because at this point, the AEC had decided to count a two-party preferred. So they decided to count Labor versus Liberal, which meant all the results, all the data on the ABC and on the national tally was wrong. And so we had the real data of what the two candidate preferreds were looking like. And so that meant suddenly all the cameras were in there, and it was becoming incredibly, incredibly tight. And we got towards the end of the night, and we're like, it was unclear. We were very close. We'd won some of the big towns, but we didn't have the pre-poll votes. And that was really the deciding factor. So on election night, we didn't know what the outcome was.
Wow. But you did soon after, and she won, right?
Yes, so, she did.
Yes, let our listeners know the fact that she won, and it was spectacular, and there was triumphant shouts, because it was a pretty dark election for many people.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was, It was the only seat in the country where an incumbent Liberal lost their seat, and it was in fact really one of the only seats in the country where there was a swing against the Liberals. So it was a bright spot on a fairly dark day for a lot of people.
And so, look, just in the time that we've got left, I want to ask you to, you know, I mean, this is what we're interested in because, in part, because this is what's happening around the country, right? So this idea of independents contesting power in spaces where there's a real sense of disenfranchisement, you know, where people are just fed up with modern politics, and often led by female candidates in most of the places, in all the places, the candidates are female. We've got lots of independents running around the country. To me, there are two interesting challenges and dilemmas that are going to be faced by those people that you've seen because you've been part of INDI for so long. The first is the challenge about what it means to go from running a campaign to actually governing. And the other one is about this question of scale. I want to talk to you about what it was, because Cathy went down to Parliament and what kind of a transition was that? You know, we've got all these independents around the country, you know, I'm sure they've got their fingers crossed that they might make it to Canberra. What kind of challenge faces them when they roll up to Parliament House?
Well, on the day where the vote was, it was announced, where Sophie conceded, Cathy turned to me and two others, Cam and Leah, who'd been working on the campaign, and she said to us, would you come work with me for the at least first 6 months while we get set up? And so we all agreed and we came along. And I remember that the shock, I guess, of walking into Parliament House, and there's a little school for new MPs. There's a little kind of like introduction to Parliament for MPs, but like, there's not much, like, and you basically just have to walk in and figure out how this place works on your own, really. And we were, all of us, just completely in over our heads. And Cathy, I think, this extraordinary pressure on her and extraordinary attention on her too, as this kind of huge news story. And she just fronted up there in Canberra, and you've got to figure it out. And there's, you know, no one really shows you the ropes. Thankfully, there were some other members of the crossbench, like Andrew Wilkie's staff and Adam Band's staff, you know, who were located nearby, and they were helpful in kind of guiding us. But like, unlike a party where you come in and you have, you know, a whole process, a whole support network that the party helps staff your office. The party, you know, takes you along with them and lets you sort of take a comfortable back seat as a backbencher while you get the ropes. But as an independent, as a crossbencher, you're there out on your own, and the scrutiny's on you from day one. And that's a tough ask. And it's very difficult to get those like systems and processes and just to get your head around the whole system. So it's a shock, and think in some ways. But I think one of the things that Cathy really committed to doing was to bring the community of INDI with her, that she really wanted to throw open the curtain and say, I didn't win this. You all did won this with me alone. Not, I wasn't alone. And to come with me and you know, that my office is always open, and my office is the kind of gateway into the building. It's not a closed door for me to represent you. I will represent you, but I also want to give you direct access to the decision makers. And so from very early on, there were teams of volunteers. Anyone in the electorate could sign up, and they would come along and get to be, you know, get an unaccompanied pass for Parliament. They would be in the office in Canberra and would have that access to any, if any minister or any bureaucrat who they wanted to see to represent their own issues. Cathy would facilitate that, and they would have that access. So I think that was a shock for the Parliament too. It was a very different way of doing things, and that it did kind of shake, I guess, some of the norms with the building too.
Yeah, because it's almost like she's placing herself as a partner to the electorate to empower everyone, rather than as like Sophie Mirabella just taking care of business for them. Completely different way of understanding politics, but it's not just her way of understanding politics. It came from the values that were generated out of the kitchen table conversations. Mm. So that's fascinating, right? So a different kind of politics, and that'll be the challenge, right? So we've got these more beautiful independents, you know. Cathy McGowan's run has inspired a change process that's really taken the nation by storm. Not only is your mum in Parliament, which is awesome, but which is also remarkable for an independent to hand to an independent. Let's just note that just never happens in Australian politics, but it happened in INDI I would suggest, because of the movement that sat underneath. But now across the country in a series of seats that could be winnable, we've got independents running. So what are your thoughts? Tell us your thoughts as someone who's been in this movement for the beginning. I'm sure that there's both inspiring and also challenging to see something that was so deeply local scale to the extent that it has. What are your tell us your reflections on the sort of the challenges and the opportunities that are coming from this the teal independence and their taking over of Australian politics.
You know, had you have asked me in 2013, is this replicable? Is it scalable? I think I would have probably maybe said no. I think in some ways it felt so specific to the geography of Indi, the political kind of context of Indi. I couldn't see how this would scale elsewhere. And I think in some ways, and I think perhaps if you had have asked me, could it happen in other regional seats, I might have said yes. Because I think the big thing that I took away from that first campaign was just how ripe and ready regional Australia is for political organizing and campaigning. I mean, it just was a case of there's just such deeply embedded social capital and such strong civic institutions in the country and also strong local media that you have. That's just a case of like it is actually ready for political organizing, and as soon as a credible candidate comes in, like watch it set on fire. Whereas to me, would that happen in the city? I would have probably said maybe not. Like to me, I guess it seems like, you know, in the city with its concentrated media markets and, you know, less, I guess, direct connection necessarily to the geographic, you know, the artificial geographic boundary you're put in as an electorate. Like it doesn't make much sense in the actual way that cities function. Like your electorate is not really a relevant place. Like it only exists once every 3 years.
It's a random loop of 90,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. And so I guess I would have thought that maybe this can't happen in the city because we're too distributed, we're too sort of spread out. But we've seen the fact that it clearly can. I mean, I think like the extraordinary turnout and engagement of volunteers in some of these, you know, quote unquote teal seats is, I think, extraordinary. And I think that it just shows that I guess there's no... that like we shouldn't take it for granted, I guess, that we've had a two-party system for all this time and we've just accepted that that's the norm, but perhaps that is not the norm and actually that can shift. You know, like multi-party parliaments and multi-party governments are common in, you know, all throughout Europe and other democracies. We've just accepted for a long time here that it's just two options and that's it. But I think we've seen that as the parties in some ways have gravitated to more similar ground, and in others that they've like, you know, perhaps changed or, you know, abandoned their base over time, that the people are seeking an alternative option, and that perhaps it's actually less to do with, you know, the geography and context, which which was very specific to Indi, and actually there's some universality there that people do want a better, that it's actually perhaps it's more about the values really. Like the, you know, if we talk about the original values of Voice for Indi, quality of leadership, like actual representation, a focus on local issues, and you know, and also the national imports, not parochialism. Like it's, you know, yes, represent local issues, but keep the broader interests in mind. These are kind of things which I think people can relate to an absence of those in their seats throughout the country. And maybe it's actually more about that than it is about the kind of specific, the context of Indi.
Yeah, and maybe one of those values is to respect and build a politics out of the local environment as it is, you know what I mean? Like to respect. And so therefore it's always going to look different, this kind of movement in different places, because the places are really different. You know, what you do in Warringah is going to be different to what you do in Indi. But the idea of having a values-based politics, maybe that is something that, I mean, people are not just searching for it in Australia. We see it through, you know, the Fearless Cities movement that runs throughout Europe, based out of Barcelona, even, you know, it more ideologically, but the Justice Democrats did such a similar process of advertising in the paper for candidates. I think they used the internet, but, you know, like that, those ideas of searching out spaces for different kinds of people practicing different kinds of politics, that feels like something that is growing and growing around the world.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the other thing is that I reckon the old right-left labels are becoming less useful. I mean, like Indi is, you know, should, you know, was labeled as a conservative, a very conservative seat. But actually what we found is that people don't really buy into that very much. Like they actually, like, every time, including this election, the Liberal Party have rolled out ads saying that, you know, Cathy McGowan is a Labor Green stooge. And this time around, they're saying actually that Cathy McGowan was not, and Helen Haynes really is. And, you know, the point is, like, no one really actually buys, and it didn't work those times, and I don't think it's going to work this time, because people don't really buy into that. They actually see, like, okay, well, I may not actually agree with everything this person stands for, but if I can understand why they're standing and I can trust them, I'm happy to have some disagreements on, you know, some issues. And those kind of fragmented issues that I think that elections are run on, those really hot button issues, like, I don't know if they actually carry as much power. Like, I think people are willing to put those aside, even if they have differing views, if they actually agree on some fundamentals in terms of the representative they're choosing.
Yes. And if you've got an enormous social network of people who are engaged, so you're not just relying on some random billboard or an ad you see on the internet, but actually there's your friends and your social network and people in your organisations are part of this, that kind of connection beats the superficial, you know, blathering, argumentative stuff that they might see on television anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't, like, you just can't argue against the power of seeing, just like, you know, right now in Indo, there are these billboards everywhere, but you can't see really anyone on the ground. Like, you know, for the Liberal Party, there's just, they're so thin in terms of people. But whereas you see in front of these attack signs, you'll see just dozens and dozens and dozens of people in orange shirts. And the strength of those numbers in compared to, you know, what is a sort of aerial campaign really of attack ads, or it just doesn't compare, and I think people see through that. Yeah, I think that's the kind of fundamental power. So I think the seats will see, who knows what will happen next week, but I think the seats will see.
Dangerous prediction, go on.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think, like, the intensity, I guess, of support and of the strength of the local networks, I think, is maybe that will be the predictor of the campaigns that succeed.
And hopefully it doesn't only herald interesting electoral outcomes, which is great, but actually what a magnificent thing it would be is if it suggested a new way for us to be able to do politics.
Absolutely.
Nick, it has been a delight and a pleasure to learn more about INDI and your work within it. Thank you so much for coming on The Changemakers.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all our episodes. This is season 6 of Changemakers, so there's also plenty in our back catalogue to inspire. If you're interested in Voices for INDI, you can pre-order their book called The People Are Interested in Politics from Laneway Press. The discount code for our listeners is Changemakers. Changemakers is produced by Lachlan Hodson. Our audio producer is Jules Walker. Our series sponsor is the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Like us on Facebook at Changemakers Podcast, and check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories. And don't forget to take a look at our organising school if you want to take a deeper dive into the art of changemaking.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.